Welcome to episode 140 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including WikiGacha. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uosa. Yes, we're alive. We disappeared for a while. I thought you thought that the podcast had sunsetted, but no, we are indeed back and alive.
Somewhat exhausted and not entirely alive, but we're chugging along.
For various reasons. Yeah, we made it through. So yeah, we were off the air for at least 2 or 3 weeks there. Sorry about that. I think we just got, we weren't prepared for the busyness of preparing for TCTC, which you were involved in. And just get right to it. I was actually sick on the weekend of TCTC, and I only made it for one of the 3 days. So that was a bit of a drag. But I got some games in, and I'm still feeling the remnants of illness, so apologies for having to blow my nose here or there during the episode.
Yes, sorry to hear that. I did thankfully manage to miss the con crud this year at TCTC. I was fairly busy with some job-related things, however. The good news being that I now am employed again, will be very soon. Of course, that's going to change my availability and time that I have for playing games. So I'll be recalculating my priorities there again, I'm sure. But in the meantime, we've got 3 courses of games to discuss.
Congratulations. It's great to be employed, but hey, our format is staying the same. Like you said, we'll have an appetizer of light news and new tidbits, things that are new to us. We'll have a main topic where we might cover one or more games. And of course, we'll be doing our off-topic topics in the dessert section at the end. Daniel, it looks like you have a bunch of news stories. Would you like to start us off?
Yeah. I've been spending this week catching up on everything I've missed over the preceding week. So a few things to throw at you here. First of all, so that my opening there makes sense, a little game called Wikipedia Gacha has come out. I believe this is an official collaboration with Wikipedia, designed by a Japanese developer, Harusugi. It's basically a digital TCG, it's free to play. I think you can buy extra packs for free. You can get like one pack a minute or something like that. But basically, each card is a Wikipedia page, or 6 million of them, or however many that is. There are some stats. Like, there is a game there that I've not really messed with. It's like the rarity of the card is based on its, what was it, the quality assessment rating. The attack is based on how many page views it's received, and the defense is like how long the article is, which, you know, how long are you going to be scrolling there for, basically. So it's a cute idea. I can't speak to how, you know, compelling the actual gameplay is. I imagine it's fairly basic in that regard, but it was a fun idea. I mean, just as an example, I figured I could crack open a pack right now. Let's have a look.
Let's see it. Yeah, I want to see it. Go for it.
Ooh, I got Raimundo Morales Angeles. Who is that? Is an officer of the Mexican Navy. There you go. We have John Bard Manulis, an American film, television, and theater producer. I know none of these people.
All right, you tempted me. I'm going to do it too.
Okay. I've got Hyena, Hap and Leonard Novella, written by American author Joe R. Lansdale.
Wow, there's also a Wikipedia text adventure game, apparently, too, which we were talking about our previous episodes. So there's a whole gaming world attached. Isn't that exciting?
Go to gamify learning knowledge.
Very cool.
Oh, here we go. The GPD Win 4 is a Windows-based palm-top computer that is a successor to the GPD Win 3, funnily enough.
That's something in our wheelhouse for sure. All right, I think the next news bit you have on the table is a game that a name that I recognize. I think this is a game that we tried out in Bellingham when we visited there last year, or maybe a year before that. Chicken Fried Dice, and this is by Urban Pro Games.
And Urban Professional Games.
Urban Professional Games, yeah. And I think this game, this campaign, is their second time out, I think?
Trick-a-D was a trick-taking game that we'd had played down there in Bellingham as well. So yeah, I've spoken about this a couple of times. We played it in Bellingham. I also got to demo it at PAX Unplugged, like 2024. So it's been circling around for a while now. Its number is finally up. It is live on Kickstarter right now. So it was exciting to see. I have a few kickstarting projects to name today. I have my relationship to crowdfunding has been a little bit mixed lately, partly because I haven't been backing anything myself for quite some time. But there are a few right now to be excited about, and this is one of them. It's a fairly simple mechanic in that you're drafting dice to fulfill orders and like create sets and numerical combinations, basically. It's fairly simple in theory, but then it adds that spice of real-time drafting, and you're all drafting simultaneously from the same pool. So, you know, it's a fairly simple twist that like just ratchets up the tension quite rapidly there. So looking forward to seeing how that one develops.
Right. And the next one on your list is something that definitely interests our local gaming group, at least our local Discord, because it's cyberpunk related. Cyberpunk is a popular genre, especially with tabletop games and video games. But in this case, this is the Cyberpunk TCG. So I guess related to the CD Projekt Red.
Literally the property Cyberpunk TM. I guess, do CD Projekt Red own that IP, including like the role-playing game now, I guess?
They may own it now, but it was extant way before, since the 1980s from our Talsorian Games. And as far as I was aware, it's still our Talsorian Games. So maybe they've given them so much money, right? They've given our Talsorian Games so much money that they might as well own it now. And maybe they do, because it's such a logical fit, or they've obviously integrated so tightly with that IP now.
This is certainly using a lot of the imagery and characters from the video game. I can't speak to how many of those were, you know, in the older role-playing game. But this is being developed by Weird Co. in collaboration with CD Projekt Red. And, I mean, what I've said there is about all I can tell you about the actual game, because you can scroll for quite some time on that Kickstarter before you learn anything about the game at all, because it's largely about what you can buy and what value you can get for that.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a big shame about the whole cyberpunk genre in general, is that now it's basically all for show. And it's all just about the aesthetics of cyberpunk, and it's not anything about being cyber or being punk.
And it's become that which it has criticized.
Exactly. It's all about making money in this
you live godless, long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Yeah, in this godless digital age, exactly.
Yeah.
We've come full circle. I still believe.
The pledges go up to like $8,000 just to get a whole bunch of booster boxes. And it just feels like pure market speculation at that point, and people trying to hoard value and assume that it might be worth something rather than being interested in the game. Like the How to Play section is just a single video to YouTube, like a YouTube video that links to. There's no actual description on the page about what the game is.
Right. Well, when nowadays the most popular TCGs are, you know, Magic the Gathering, which is just like a IP farming, it's a collectible farming game now. It's actually a competitive game that people play for fun anymore. It's just to spin licenses. And the other one is, Disney's Lorcana or whatever. I don't know. Let's just be honest. TCGs have always been about spinning IPs, haven't they? Even from the early days. When we had things like, the Golden Girls TCGs and things like that. So I guess it's always been that case.
I mean, I still enjoy cracking some magic packs, but that's very much exclusive from the business model.
I'm never gonna touch Magic the Gathering booster pack again, just like I'm not ever going to buy a D&D product again, because like, what's the point?
They're just I will so hard. Gladly spend $1.25 for the Dollarama, like, they like take bulk cards and like pre-package them into new boosters, which is worth zero amount of money, but it's just basically good fun to like, it's a very economical way of like playing with random cards, essentially.
Oh, of course. And anyone is welcome to play with their old cards or whatever. It's just like, now what's
the make your own enjoyment.
Yeah. Of course. Anyways, I'm going to get off my soapbox there. Do you have more campaigns?
Yeah, just quickly. Lion Dancers from friends of the show Hot Banana, who have previously discussed their games Steam Up and Moon Bunnies. And it's just always exciting to see them bring a very specific cultural awareness to board games. This time, obviously, with the Chinese tradition of lion dances, which we've just experienced. I was at the one of the local grocery stores, TNT. TNT and when literally the line dancers came through and were throwing lettuce around the grocery store. So yeah, that's very much a well-represented tradition here, even in Vancouver. And that board game, the campaign is over now, but you can late pledge, of course. But it's another relatively simple, accessible board game. It's designed for sort of family groups and things like that, but bringing a new spin to that tradition.
Yeah, and I saw that Hot Banana Game was at TCTC, yeah. Of course. They were demoing the line dancers, and they were also looked like they were demoing a prototype as well.
Yes.
I didn't get to talk to them, despite the fact that I was demoing many games on that one day I was there.
Yes, that's another one I got to demo previously at Protocon last year. That's I don't know how much is, that is public knowledge yet, but it's another very fun piece of Chinese culture that they're
exploring. Yeah, it was kind of like this cool, like 3D, very
interesting. It had vertical tiers, shall we say.
Right. Maybe a three-dimensional take on the, what was it, their dim sum game, Steam Up.
Yes, yeah.
Because it's always fun to spin. It's always fun to spin Lazy Susans.
Mm-hmm. So recently, I was talking about a bunch of word games. One of my favorites was Illiterati, and it is currently back on Kickstarter with a couple of expansions. That is from Gap Closer Games, and I can't remember the name of the expansions. Oh, here they are: Red Herrings and White Roses. And it's basically adding some new scenarios to the game. And what I really enjoyed about Illiterati was the sort of themed challenges to how you're creating words. Like you have to create this restaurant, you're creating words that's all related to banking or to holidays. And this adds a new spin on that with a challenge maybe being to have to combine several words into like a Scrabble formation, like going vertically and horizontally, or having to stack words, like creating a word that you have to, you can stack letters on. Like, I think it's called Upwards. That was like the Scrabble spin. We have to like, you stack them to make a new word. So yeah, exploring that with some more spins and abilities on Illiterati, which I had a lot of fun with.
Very cool. Let's hear more.
Yes, our final game in the crowdfunding bunch for today. That is Rematch, the Puzzle Fighter board game from Brother Ming Games. And if you're at all cynical about some of the FOMO in and corporations taking over Kickstarter, this is just a really vibrant expression of artistry that I enjoyed. It's basically a fighting game, but you're using like marbles coming down a track. It's not exactly match three. I think you're trying to group certain colors together to power up these sort of fighting moves, essentially. But it has this real a strong sense of an interface. Like you, basically the board is like this arcade machine, and with the balls sort of sliding down in front of that, and this is some really incredible art going into that, so really excited to see what comes of that one.
Yeah, that is based off of the Capcom / SNK video game though, right? Puzzle Fighter.
I'm not sure. I assumed Puzzle Fighter was more of a description, but maybe it is an official adaptation.
No, there's a video game called Puzzle Fighter that's sort of like a match three game.
Oh, okay.
It's featured like licensed characters, like Street Fighter characters like Chun-Li and Ryu and stuff like that. And I think there was actually a previous tabletop game that has also mimicked that game. It was like something... It was one of the first bag building games.
Yes, because it had chips, I know the one you're talking
and
you about.
Put it in a bag, so it's
that's what I was thinking of when I hear Puzzle Fighter.
Yeah, it has a retro flair to it because for some reason people really dig that. I guess it's because it is a puzzle game built right into it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Excellent. Okay, well, that's it for our current crowdfunding. There was one upcoming project that I wanted to talk a little bit about too, though, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And that you've shouted out a few IP-based TTRPGs, like the recent Ghost in the Shell announcement. But one that's particularly interesting to me is Children of Time. This is based on the book by Adrian Tchaikovsky. And while I've previously discussed that I'm a little cynical about IP-based TTRPGs, at least I don't find much appeal in them, I think this is taking it in a slightly different direction, because that book is basically this sci-fi story about like generational ships and uplifted species. It covers this generational period of time across thousands of years, and you see, you know, cultures grow and expand and collapse, and in with the way these cultures interact, the iconic one in that first book in the series is this basically uplifted spiders, and how society is very different when you're looking at intelligent spiders, basically. This game, being published by Rowan Rook and Deckard, doesn't look to be playing with specific characters or settings, but rather that framework of taking an uplifted species which you will create yourself, and a generational ship that you will grow yourself and experience over the generations, and then how they clash when they finally meet at the end. So it's playing with a few different modes of play. And again, a really fascinating narrative framework rather than, you know, forcing the settings and as a, I recognize that type phenomenon.
Yeah, well, I am a fan of sci-fi, as you know, and I'm also a fan of Rowan Rook and Deckard. Actually, the next TTRPG I'm planning to play was published by them. It's a little old game called Eat the Reich, which is all about the zombie assassination squad out to kill Hitler, or drink his blood, not technically kill him, just drink all of his blood. There's a distinction.
Yeah, so that one's coming out later in June, I believe. So definitely keep an eye out for that. I'll be keeping a close look at it myself.
Right on. All right. That's lots of games to be looking forward to. You'll notice there wasn't a lot of news for me. I took a look around after I'd taken, you know, several sick days and attended TCTC for the one day. And all around, it seemed like time had passed in a haze. And I realized, oh, I haven't been on social media in like a week or two. I don't even remember how long it's been, so I don't know. I think I might go cold turkey and just get rid of it all, which I know is not helping the podcast very much. I'm sorry. The podcast is a thing online. I realize that. But I think it's been good, mental health-wise.
It's pretty dire out there still, I will say, so you're not missing much.
Yeah, well, I jumped back on in on it, and I was like, wow, not missing any of this stuff. See you guys.
Don't you want to debate DLSS 5?
I will check back in another week. See if the world's gotten any better or any worse.
Okay, well, in the meantime, why don't we jump over to our main course?
That's right. We're still playing games here, though. We're still playing lots of different games. So did you want to cover the big game that we both played?
Well, why don't we just quickly run through... I think we're going to quickly run through our TCTC experiences, which is going to be very short.
Yes, and we're just going to, I guess, touch upon that, because maybe we might elaborate on some of those games in the future.
Yeah. So, I've talked about before, I run the registration there at Terminal City Tabletop Convention, which kept me pretty busy most of the weekends. Being on call, I did manage to squeeze in a little bit of hot streak at the security desk, basically, as I think it was on Friday night, as people were sort of streaming out. We'd set up this tiny, tiny little table, and it was really a fun experiment in how small of a table you can play hot streak on. But we had like a full 6-player group of that, I think. A lot of people walking out of the hall were really excited and cheering us on, so that was a fun experience. I did get to play some Slam Throne. The Pogs are back in Pog form from Dice Throne. I picked up a little bit of that to play with my daughter at some point. And I did also this year finally book myself a slot in the RPG room for the first time and got off my bucket list Cloud Empress, which I'll talk a little bit about sometime, I think.
Congratulations. Yeah. Like I said, I was only attending one of the days. So I got sick on the Friday. I actually took the day off work, hoping that I could recover in time for the first full day on Saturday. I didn't attend the first, obviously. I did go on Saturday. I had some commitments. I promised the organizers, like Andrea, that I would help do a little bit of volunteering of my own right. It was very easy, though. Nothing compared to your hard work. I agreed to test some of the indie games. So there's the big indie alley, and there were like so many tables. I don't even know. There was like over 30 or something, right? It was quite large.
Something like that, yeah. A lot of prototypes, people coming in from out of province, from the US, was really great to see. A lot of games I recognize from Protocon and previous conventions, and a bunch I'd never heard of before, which is always a nice surprise.
Yeah, and it's actually a pretty central part of the con, because it runs pretty much the entire length of the con, right from the entrance gate to the far back wall of the convention, all in one row, and then like basically two rows of tables kind of lining either side of the main corridor, I guess you would say. And that's not entirely true, because one side of that was an RPG space. But that said, it's quite impressive. I played about 8 or 10 demos there, and I contributed a little bit in my small way to the judging of those. And I think there were some awards given on the third day, but obviously I did not attend that. So congratulations to the winner.
Do you not know who the winner is?
I don't know who the winner is. Do you recall?
Your old podcast host, Mark Ellis.
Oh, fantastic. That's really cool. I actually did get to a little demo of Mark's game, and I recused myself.
Planet Rollers, I think it's called.
Yes. I recused myself because I have a personal relationship with him, but I thought it was really cool.
Excellent.
And let's get Mark or his partner, Noe, who run the Vancouver Playtest group together, because they did some cool stuff. Noe had a cool game of his own.
Spellerbee, I think it's called. I've played that at Protocon.
Right. And they as a group, shared a table, which I thought was very brave of them.
Well, I think they actually had like half a dozen people that were sort of rotating through over the weekend.
Exactly, yeah. Noe had his own table, and then half a dozen people were sharing one table, which I thought was really wild. Anyways, I tested a bunch of cool games, but I don't want to spend, conversely, too little time describing them, because they were all quite cool. So I did that, and then I played I played two games that day. I played a skirmish game, which ironically was my second skirmish game of that week. Last week I played, for the very first time, One Page Rules, which is a cool, basically like open license version of basically Warhammer, like Kill Team, cool. Essentially. So I played that with my neighbors. And then a few days later, on that Saturday, I played Brick Wars, which is another cool skirmish game, which is played using Lego bricks. So that's a really cool system. So thank you to, I think it was Zaphod who demoed that. And I did not win that session. I of course, in a three-way war, I made the silly mistake of rushing into the center, and I got clobbered from both sides. I did make it right to the end, though, and we had a very interesting climax of we were all each down to our heroes. It's because you have your hero, and then you have the rest of your peons.
Fun.
So that was fun. And then I played one more TTRPG, which was on my bucket list, and I thoroughly enjoyed. I played a little old TTRPG indie darling called Triangle Agency, which was kind of like the big indie game TTRPG of last year, I think. Mm. And I don't want to touch upon it too much, but except to say that I thoroughly enjoyed myself, and I'd like to speak on it more in the future. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Nathan, who was our GM. I had played a game with him the previous year. He had run Vason, which I enjoyed that. I enjoyed this one as well. It was actually one of the best RPG sessions I've had. And it was thoroughly, thoroughly laugh out loud funny and really, really amoral and licentious. There was so much going on. It was out of this world. So that was super cool. So TCTC, I wasn't able to spend much time there, but I had a blast every moment when I was there.
Yeah, it was fantastic to see a bunch of familiar faces and a few we'd not seen at TCTC before, traveling in from out of province. And even just in the RPG room, we saw such a diverse range of games being played. And yeah, always great to see. I saved just behind me, you might be able to see a dragon that was the mascot. I saved that from the aftermath of the convention. So it lives on.
Yeah, that's great. And of course, there was the return of the fantastic used game sale. That's pretty much one of the biggest highlights of that whole show. I bought a few used RPG books, which I'll be talking about eventually about those as well. And the vendors are great. There were some great return vendors, there were some new ones, and there were like so many such great representation of indie RPGs and stuff, and I wish I was able to spend a little bit more time there, but do what we can.
Yes, Composed Dream, an online TTRPG retailer, were hosting the, I can't remember the exact name, but it's basically a new award for Canadian TTRPGs. So I'll definitely have to follow up with them and see how that's coming along.
Yeah, another great thing that TCTC does is just like connect, obviously, people who love games and people that are doing cool projects with games. So you know, just like I met Nathan, fantastic GM. It would be great if we can kind of like build upon these relationships. It's much easier for you because you're or you're in with the organizers. But yeah, so many cool ideas. I'll definitely be talking to the Vancouver Playtest group people, and I want to follow up on their cool projects. And there's still cool games that are being created out there, and I like to see grassroots people making games on their own, not just companies and licenses.
Yep. Even though I didn't get to play much, it definitely energized me to get out there and experience more that the gaming scene has to offer, and I'm excited to get some new experiences to the table soon.
Fantastic. Hear, hear. Well, you may be hearing more from some of those games in the coming weeks. Okay, for now, should we move on to a Meteor game that we played?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't recall if we teased this at all, but it might not be a huge surprise considering some of the games I've been talking about lately.
Yeah, sorry about the kind of repetition on a theme that you might be hearing a little bit, but I decided to follow your lead and play. What was the game that you recommended, Daniel?
That is Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Yes, that's right. That was a game that was on my to-do list for a long time, my backlog for a long time. And you actually reminded me when we were just before we started recording, is like, have I beaten any Castlevania games? The most direct relationship I have with Castlevania was playing that one GBA game over and over, the Game Boy black and white Castlevania game over and over and over in my youth. And I guess that made me think Castlevania games are slow, plodding, and difficult, challenging platformers that are sort of unforgiving, which lots of games from that generation were. Let's be honest, you played most of them. I think you said as much in our previous episodes when
we talked about them. Yeah, I've discussed most of those previous games, like 10 or so of them, over the last several episodes. And there is some diversion within them. But Symphony of the Night is definitely a huge, a new generational shift in what these games are, essentially.
Yeah, and let's just say that this game came out in 1997 for the... It wasn't originally for the PlayStation, right? Eventually came
out. I believe so. A PS1 was the original, yeah.
Okay. I think it was for other platforms,
too. Sega Saturn, and, I mean, it's been ported to most platforms since.
That's right. I own it for PlayStation Network, so you could have played it on PSP. I could have played it on PSP or Vita, but I ended up playing it on the TrimUI brick, which is great because it's a nice, you know, 3-4 dimensions game. Like the PlayStation 1 generation was, and it looks beautiful. Was this the first one that introduced the more role-playing mechanics?
Well, funnily enough, no. I mean, as I've discussed before, Castlevania 2, like way back, actually played with a lot of this. It had a level-up system. It was a non-linear exploration game, and it was rather obtuse and simple in how it did so. But this is pulling a lot from that in the leveling-up mechanics, at the very least.
All right, so we can't say that this was the first Metroidvania, is the popular term. But I've even heard the term Igavania, because the gentleman, what is his name? Iga, his last name is Iga, is a director of the game?
No, Koji Igarashi.
All right, Igarashi.
Okay.
Yeah, some people call these Igavania games, so I thought he was instrumental in bringing back some of those non-linear adventure games, but you're saying that that has had its DNA since even as early as Castlevania 2. Maybe you could say that this is the first one where they really doubled down and expanded upon that non-linearity and also doubling down on the RPG elements. This game definitely fits that Metroidvania mold, and you're going to be exploring non-linearly, and you're going to be leveling up. And so this game, I thought, was actually really gentle to get into. The leveling up model is quite gentle, like I said. You start off very simple, basic. Instead of whips, you have swords because you're playing as Alucard, Dracula's son. And I don't know, I didn't access a single whip when playing as him. There is an intro section where you play as one of the Belmonts, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, curiously, this starts with a bang. You It basically, you replay the final boss from Rondo of Blood. Because this is a direct sequel to that game. I think it's set like 3 years after that. But you play the final boss as Richter Belmont fighting Dracula again. You are quite overpowered. I don't know that if you can lose that. Like, even if you... I think if you lose, something happens, and like a bit of a deus ex. And you beat the game anyway. And then it jumps to you playing Alucard 3 years later. And similarly, a very overpowered before it pulls that old trope of let's take all your abilities away, so you get a little taste of what's to come.
Exactly. You can't play a Metroidvania game at full power. You have to lose everything and of course gain it all back, which you do in this game. And I just thought that this game would be a lot harder, kind of like nail-biting, challenging, kind of grueling action platformer game like the early 80s games were. And I found that this was really just the opposite. It was just kind of slow, kind of meditative. The platforming was almost never that difficult. And even the bosses were pretty tame. I don't know. What do you think about the difficulty compared to the other Castlevania?
Definitely, probably the easiest. Partly because you can sort of grind out and level. You've got various options in how you're going to combat that difficulty. Basically, I think the older games they are all difficult, but they were always largely felt fairly fair in the difficulty curve. They all started fairly easy and then got much harder in it with a fairly consistent increase, at least. But this is fairly easy most of the way through, even the bosses. And because it's so much more about exploration of both the physical space and exploration of systems with all the different options in combat that you have, that seems to be much more the focus than like just mastery of combat in those previous games. Because, I mean, in the older Castlevania games, you really only had like two options. You had your whip, and that's largely, again, about timing. This very carefully paced in the timing of when you're going to shoot that, because there's very little control over it. And the sub-weapons, you can carry one sub-weapon at a time, whether that's an axe or a dagger or a holy water. Right. And that was a sort of limited resource. And while you don't have a whip here, the sort of various swords and staves you get as Alucard function fairly similarly, but he's definitely a lot more agile. It's funny you said that this is a very slow, meditative game, because it is much more fast-paced than any of the previous kind of Castlevania games.
Yeah.
In being very fluid in the way you bounce and jump around.
I guess I say it's slow in the sense that like you pace yourself, right? You can go in any direction. You can kind of like just see what's around this corner and check things out. And those elements are still there. You still have your primary weapon and the sub-weapon, which you can carry one at a time. And most of those are repeats of previous entries. You got your stopwatch. You got your bottle of holy water.
The salt. You can sort of throw some salt at the enemies. I think it's salt, or maybe it's something else.
Yeah, and no, salt is. It has, what is it? Antiseptic qualities, so it was thought to hold back demonic forces. That's why you put salt at doorways salt circles, and entrances. Yeah. And salt circles, that's right. But of course, they just have the dagger, they have the axe, so those are classics. And then in this game, interestingly, it has a kind of like dual wielding kind of element. So basically, the UI is the north button is back. The bottom button is jump and then accept. And then the left and the right buttons on the control pad, the face buttons, the west and the east buttons are your left and your right weapon. So you can have two-handed weapons or two single weapons, or you can have a single-handed weapon and, of course, like a shield or something like that.
Yeah, the shield you actually bring up manually, like you That's hold right. it in front of you like a Dark Souls or something, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting from like a design perspective. In that sense, it's sort of like preceding games like Skyrim, where being two-handed is literally baked into the design ethos of the game. I thought it was a little bit superfluous because I primarily utilize the one weapon in my primary hand, and I very rarely utilize the secondary weapon if I needed to. Couple bosses, pretty much you were forced to have a shield or something like that. Sometimes I use that, and then you also had to awkwardly equip items to your hand to use them, like uncursed, if you got cursed by certain enemies.
Or the food to regain health.
That's right. You had to equip it to a hand, throw it onto the ground, and then run to it to eat it. So I thought that was a little silly.
Just throw that wall chicken on the ground and go to town.
Yeah, it worked in the end. At least you can pick up food and then eat it at a later time. That's a really nice option.
Yeah, it is a little clunky, but you have a lot of options there. I don't think I actually used the shields at all. I never found it necessary, considering how easy the game was. But you have, in addition to like your sub-weapons, there are also other consumable weapons that are in your inventory, other daggers and throwable things. There's magic spells that are consumable that you can use. There's a whole magic system that basically works like a fighting game combos. Yep. Like I think you have to buy them, but then, oh, now you can do up, down, left, right, AAA to do a fireball or something like that. I only messed with that a bit. I found it was a little too fiddly to execute in the chaos of battle. But there are a lot of options there.
Yeah, I think that was a bit of a superfluous system. I didn't use it much at all. And I think it was maybe just a nod to like the Street Fighter craze of the time. Because this is 1997, let's recall. Like that time, pretty much like Street Fighter was king of the hill. So it was probably just a little nod to that kind of comboing aspect.
Well, if you go to the library, you can buy basically guides to all of the bosses that you've already beaten. It'll show you a little video of Richter, I think, fighting that boss. And they're all executing like uppercuts and fireballs and Hadoukens and all kinds of like really out there powers. So it's clear that there's a lot of, there's a high skill ceiling to execute here if you want to really lean into that.
That's the kind of wild thing about this system, is that it's a very, like, it's a very basic game design with lots of robust extra features that people, like, don't even have to touch at all to get through this relatively low difficulty game. You know, I was really quite surprised. There are, well, let's run through some more basics. So there's spells, like you said. There's equipment, which we already covered. There's also relics.
Mm-hmm.
And relics are these sort of like, kind of like ultimates.
Well, they're your classic sort of Metroidvania upgrades, basically.
Yeah, they're the persistent, passive upgrades. But interestingly enough, this game lets you turn them on and off selectively.
That feels very modern, funnily enough.
Yeah, I like that. I like that, actually, because I imagine it helps certain styles of players who would feel like they wouldn't want to lean on some of these kind of boosts that, let's admit it, kind of break the game. Like, what is a action platformer game? Is it an action platformer game when you gain the ability to fly at will? Which, spoilers, you do gain the ability to fly, and it becomes sort of central to certain puzzles. Can you really call them puzzles if you just fly? I don't know. I thought some of those were antithetical to the challenge of an action platformer. And they kind of feel, well, some of them were just straight up like mysterious, like, what does this thing even do? And then others were a little nice, but not ultimately that revolutionary. Like, you can have companions, you can have familiars.
Summons, yeah.
Yeah, you can have familiars, which just kind of like hang around and like lightly attack things, which,
well, there doesn't... is some like some of them can interact with secrets as well, I found.
Yeah, I suppose there are. And then some of them were just like straight up game breaking, like that ability to fly, and others were just like immunity to things, or some existed only to facilitate puzzles, only to unlock new areas, for, let's just say. So relics is another thing. What were other elements? That's pretty much it, right? Spells, equipment.
Oh, there's like rings or like various, basically Final Fantasy, like accessories, I guess you'd call
it. Yeah, equipment slots for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, there are a lot of options there. And it definitely feels more like a role playing game, more than your classic Metroidvania. Because everyone points to this as being the prototypical entry of that genre. But I don't know of any other Metroidvania that has led into, like, into RPG elements quite so much as this one. And it really does let you create your own sense of difficulty and expressivity in how you approach the game.
Yeah, this is definitely more than just a Metroidvania. I know that even in games like Metroid, you do level up per se, but you only really have like one or two stats, and they mostly
increase max health or something.
Yeah, they mostly funnel you towards things that you're already doing. This game, like, lets you choose a lot But strangely enough, I feel like the design is a little like a buffet, you know? It's just like, it doesn't seem very, very precise or spare or focused. It just kind of seems like a scattershot. The exploration, there's definitely some secrets. Some of them I was scratching in my head, but others were fairly obvious when you came down to it.
Only a couple of obtuse things. It was hard to figure out how you could interact with the world, yeah.
There are, I guess I'll just say, there are a lot of, like, secrets in this game. And I don't know, you have the perspective to say, is this a continuation of a legacy of secrets? But I thought that this game, being the Castlevania I spent the most time with now, interesting in that they don't explain a lot of things. Like, they give you access to things, and they don't really tell you what they do. They have some challenges, like there's like a New Game Plus mode, but they don't really teach you how to get there. You have to figure it out by combining this item and that item. And they have some secondary characters, which we haven't touched upon. There's Alucard, there's the Richter Belmont, right?
Yes.
Who is the character from that prologue. And then there's Dracula, of course, who is also in that prologue. And then there's this secondary character, a helper. What is her name? Maria?
I believe. Maria. She was a playable character in Rondo of Blood.
Okay. So she's a returning character, and she gives you a lot of, like, just exposition. It's just like, oh, I see you're here to blah, blah, blah. You're not such a bad guy. And she helps give you some clues, I suppose, about this or that. I think she even gives you, like, missions, right? Like, light missions.
Gives you directions, at the very least, yeah.
Yeah. I guess she's giving you kind of, like, cryptic direction. But that's fairly minor. I feel like that only really happened, like, 3 or 4, maybe 5 times in the whole game.
Yeah, I mean, and to be clear, this is voice acted. I won't say that it's well voice acted. It is all very stilted dialogue like this.
Yeah. It's pretty much Resident Evil 1.
Yeah, the Jill sandwich. Yeah.
Jill, you're the master of unlocking level voice acting, but that's part of its charm too, I guess you could say. It's a product of its time.
Yes.
Yeah, the voice acting is pretty terrible, and also just from an audio perspective, like, highly compressed and almost painful to listen to with how it's, like, clipping at certain points. It's remarkable what we accepted, even for, I guess, like, a CD game, right? Like, that's how they could fit such large audio samples in a game, is because it was on the CD medium for the first time. Maybe not the first time. I don't know if Rondo of Blood was disc-based either.
I don't recall. That was the PC Engine one, yeah.
Okay, where was I? Also, this game, I don't know if it was so well received at the time. I know that it's considered sort of like legendary and one of the greatest of all time now.
My understanding from Wikipedia is that it did not sell particularly well at first. It became a cult classic over time.
Right, and I think I can understand why. Is basically like this was on the PlayStation, this was on the Sega Saturn, but it was largely modeled on an older style of game.
And everyone was looking for 3D at that point.
That's right, and this game is staunchly 2D. It has a, you know, a fine 3D intro movie, sure, and it has a 3D ending movie, obviously, as well. It has 3D elements, but they're all fairly minor. Like, I could probably count them on one hand. There's the, kind of the effect when you're at the saving, there's like a 3D
a D20 or something, whatever it is.
Yeah, there's a 3D kind of gemstone, and it twirls, and then it turns into a coffin. There's some interesting stuff in the background in the sky. The sky pattern is strangely raging.
It looks like the turbo graphics, the way it's sort of blasting past quite rapidly. Yeah,
there's actually some cool, more subtle effects that are really impactful, I thought. Like, there's a room fairly central that's like a kind of a cathedral, and it has stained glass. Do you know that room?
Yeah, you see the background sort of moving, sort of semi-3D background.
Right,
yeah.
When you walk, the background sort of parallaxes in a faux 3D effect, and I thought that was very nice. But all in all, very, very minor utilization of some of the newer graphical powers of the new system. So I could see why people of the time might have been disappointed that this wasn't, you know, the first full 3D entry in the series. That wouldn't be coming for quite some time.
It's interesting because it's a series that's always been 2D, but has even then struggled with graphical performance across the SNES generation. Those games are really struggling under their ambition, and like were quite stiff. They were felt very like very stiff, and this is really like finally fulfilling the promise of what you. The 2D game can do with that full powerhouse behind it and empowering the graphics to a much more fluid extent.
Yeah, that's right. And I believe that this is a good utilization of that new hardware and that new power. I think actually it's the visual improvements and elements are subtle but quite cool to look at. I think the voice acting is pretty painful by modern standards, but good probably for the time. See, the CG movies are fine, totally the same sort of standard thing.
Yeah, my version didn't have that apparently, because I was actually playing on Xbox. I had like a 360 port. Apparently it was one of the first games on the 360 Xbox Live, like when there were games were limited to like 50 megabytes or something, and so they actually had to cut those FMV sequences out of the game.
Oh, that's really unfortunate. I mean, like they're just fine or whatever.
Yeah,
but like it seems like counterintuitive to be on a newer platform, and you had to cut the few modern elements were of a game of that time. Ironic. Anyways, I think that this is a good execution of that. And like you said, the power of the newer systems allow for that fluid movement. It allows for large gaming environments. And the castle, basically you're all navigating within one castle. Like, you enter a gate, the gate closes behind you, you can't leave. You're in it, you're going from roof to steeple, you're going to catacombs, you reach all the way to the opposite wall, it tells you it's the outer wall, you go all the way back to the other side, you reach another wall, you reach the left wall, you go to the north, you go to the sub-catacombs.
Colosseum in the middle for some reason.
Yeah, that was an interesting
move. It doesn't entirely make sense, but it does have a great sense of space from like the steeples at the top to the catacombs down below.
Yeah, it feels like there are different like biomes. Like say if this was a spaceship, like a generational ship, and this is like, hey, you've entered the new Colosseum zone. Congratulations. The environments feel distinct and cool, and they have distinctive enemies and distinctive patterns, and you know the challenge level can actually go up quite a bit in certain regions compared to the region just adjacent to it, depending on the order in which you unlock them. So I think this is like a high quality game, and there's a reason why people consider it to be so legendary. I was just surprised at how easy this game was to beat, and I completed it. I rolled credits anyway, which I know is not the true ending, but I rolled credits without much difficulty because you can basically unlock exploits, not true exploits. These are things that the game lets you do. Equip equipment that makes you pretty much invulnerable to the attacks of the final boss, and then beating the final boss is a cinch.
Yeah, and I think it was only like one phase too, which is normally like the final bosses in these games are multi-phase affairs. But again, I'm not sure how much the expectation is that you would go to it's not quite New Game Plus. It is like a whole extra chapter of the game to get the true ending. I mean, I don't think it's really a spoiler for a 30-year-old game, but it's the inverted castle, basically the same world upside down, and you have to navigate that space and with some different objectives. And I only played an hour or so of that. It did seem a fair bit more difficult from what I saw so far. I did beat a couple of the bosses, though. It wasn't like... It was only a slight step up, really. And again, I never really had major difficulties, except for like a few of the floating heads and a few other enemies. And one thing that continues to frustrate me in this series from the beginning is knockbacks. When the enemies run into you, they will knock you back, and it's quite easy to fall into this sort of stun lock pattern in certain areas, especially with enemies that are spawning repeatedly.
Right, they can knock you back literally into the next screen, which is pretty darn annoying when you just walked in.
And then they regain all their health, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and then everything respawns and resets again. Yeah, that was quite annoying. I also played into the New Game Plus, and even before reaching there, it was interesting in that you can get to the final boss and not be prepared to beat him. which is nice, right? Yeah. Like you have the ability to go there and without having to unlock literally everything before that point, I decided, well, I can't beat this guy as I am right now. So I did. It forced me to explore more, and that allowed me to unlock more things. And eventually I became overpowered and I beat him quite easily after unlocking more of those elements. That's
the general appeal of these games, right? You're doubling back over the same area a dozen times and you really feel how you've grown and how you're suddenly defeating these monsters that were tricky before. You're now killing them in one sweep of your sword and breezing through. And so there's this real sense of power progression.
And it's satisfying, and this is not a revelation, it's just satisfying to unlock that map, isn't it? It's just like, this is the unexplored area, here's the map, I finally got to explore that, or unlock it with this new power-up, and it just feels like you're filling in puzzle pieces in a literal jigsaw puzzle, so that's nice. The Inverted Castle, I didn't find it easily. I knew it existed, so that wasn't a spoiler for me. I knew it existed, and I was seeking it out. How do I find this? I didn't find it organically. Mm. I had to end up searching some message boards about it. And it was like, you have to have this equipment and this equipment. And I had one of them naturally, and the other one I had to stumble upon, because it's like, you have to have this other equipment before it. And so this game, mysteries, right? This game has those mysteries built into them from the beginning, from a long time ago. And I thought it was quite audacious, in retrospect, to have designed the entire castle to be played in upside down. And in some cases, there were some really illogical level designs.
It doesn't feel as organic upside down, shall we say.
Right, right. And it doesn't even feel that organic right side up, because you're always looking, why is the floor designed this way? Or why is the roof designed that way? It's because how else are you going to traverse it? I didn't really love the Inverted Castle. I thought, well, yeah, this is a slight difficulty bump, but it just kind of felt more of the same. And there is some charm in playing through those same levels upside down, but it's sort of also gimmicky.
Diminishing returns at that point.
Right.
There are a lot of new enemies, at least, I will say, and the new bosses.
Sure. Yeah, there are new things. I'm not going to say there isn't. It isn't worth playing, but it's more of that same flavor. It's more of the same buffet. It's just like more reskins. I kind of compare it to something that a later game would do. Mario Kart 8, the longest running series that has been run over multiple Nintendo systems, and they've re-released it and re-released it and re-released it so many times. Their greatest innovation of one generation was, we're giving you 30 new tracks. They're the tracks that you know, except now you can drive backwards on them.
Well, I just finished Donkey Kong Country Returns recently, and like one of the final unlocks you get is Mirror Mode. It's like, it's this huge reveal. It's like, I'm not playing the same game again.
I know. It's kind of cheap. It's kind of a cheap response to basically like recreating more content, right? Is by, you can go backwards. It's not exactly the same, because you're not literally doing it. Obviously, they had to, in the first case, design something that could be inverted, but it's just like playing some more of the same old stuff. So I think in both our cases, we're reviewing this without having completed the final true ending of the game.
And I believe there is like something you can unlock later to basically replay the game as Richter with the whip, with like, you know, a whole different tool set of moves and things. There's probably quite a bit of replayability there too.
Yeah, and actually Richter and Alucard play quite differently from each other. Just the fact that the whip is there. Like, I felt it when I tried to do a new game. It's like playing the intro after the whole game, playing with Alucard's sword. Playing with that whip for those first few minutes felt weird, and also felt like kind of coming home in a way too, because you expect the action to work that way in a Castlevania game.
I think there are some versions where Maria is also playable again, because she was playable in Rondo of Blood, but like played very differently with like summons, largely like throwing out birds and cats as attacks, which you might be familiar with from Vampire Survivors. I know there's the analog there. She's very different as well.
Yeah, so Castlevania games, they're sort of like an engine for creating these sort of non-linear games. You can remix the parts, you can remix the characters, you can even remix the castle. And this game is kind of a game of remixes, I feel like. I think they do it pretty well. Speaking of remixes, the music's pretty damn good.
Yeah, we need to mention that at some point.
The music's pretty damn good. It's kind of like legendary, right?
Well, it goes from in so many different directions, like this sort of really gothic, classical epics to, you know, thrash metal and prog rock to like Dead Mall Muzak in the Colosseum for some reason. I don't know. Yeah. It's very strange.
And really like kind of like gentle, like kind of Fury Lee's kind of piano pieces too. So like it covers the whole gamut for sure. Mm. And I think the visual style holds up. Like, this game, like, looks really sharp. I think some of the animations look surprisingly smooth.
Pretty crisp. The
Alucard looks really dynamic. You know, the reason why it maybe feels faster is because, like, his animation looks like he's literally warping forward.
There's this weird ghosting effect as he moves, right? I couldn't... It's a little... It's hard to read sometimes. It's very busy, shall we say.
Is it just that there's more frames per second than any other Castlevania before it?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, probably since that 128-bit system or whatever that PS1 is lets you have that sort of power.
Mm.
So I thought this game was great. I think it was very worthy of playing. I might even, if I get bored later, continue to play through the inverted castle.
Oh, I'm definitely doing that, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not like... dying to go back and play through that. But I thought every moment that I played was smooth, enjoyable. Even the mild challenges, I was like, I kept going back to them. And a lot of the bosses I just beat on the first try. And very few of them did I have to go back 2, 3, 4 times.
Mm.
But they were all enjoyable. They looked great.
And a lot of like duo bosses as well.
I guess there were. And there were some really interesting ones like... There were some, like the ball of flesh or whatever.
Yeah, it's like the hundreds of bodies in one giant orb.
Yeah, that one was like the one of the coolest 2D bosses I've ever played in a game. And I'm like, how did they do that at the time? It's like, what is it? Hieronymus Bosch painting or something like that come to life. Some really cool metal kind of design here.
Very over the top. Very, very good pulpy horror fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that the series does continue down this line of evolution, mostly for the future games. I'm looking forward to exploring those at some point. This was my main goalpost for this, to see this line of evolution up to this point. I will continue at some point once I don't know, if I settle into my new work schedule, I guess. But yeah, it's been a fun journey.
Yeah, I might continue. I might try and continue following with you because I actually own some of the collections. Mm-hmm. So there are, Konami came out with collections of the, basically most of the Castlevania games, but the ones that I purchased most recently were the GBA ones. So there's at least 3 GBA entries in the Castlevania series. And there's also 3 DS entries in the Castlevania series. And each of them has like a cute little name. Like I think the Dominus collection holds the DS games. So you can go get that on a variety of platforms, but definitely on Switch and Steam.
Well, the old one out that I'm quite interested to get to, I think might actually be next, is Castlevania 64, which was 3D, which is like doesn't is the only 3D up until Lords of Shadows, I think, which was like the last Castlevania game.
But there are 2 Lords of Shadows, though, right?
Yes, 1 and 2. Yeah.
Yeah, Castlevania, it'll be interesting when we reach the reviews of the 3D generation, because I don't think Castlevania has knocked it out of the park in 3D yet, or at least it doesn't seem to have blown away the world, the audience, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that those games have their fans, so I'm curious to see how they compare. And of course, we have Belmont's Shadow, I think, the new game coming out later this year.
And of course, we have Vampire Survivors, Vampire Crawlers.
Yes.
The demo of which I did play, which I'll have some thoughts about in the future.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's now actually officially connected to Vampire, to Castlevania universe.
Mm-hmm. And one final point. I mean, I've talked about in comparing this series how I think Zelda really deserves its place in this genre. And reading from Igarashi basically saying that when they were making Symphony of the Night, they were thinking Zelda. Like, Metroid was not really a consideration at all.
There you go. Yeah, I think Zelda deserves to exist within the pantheon of non-linear exploration games. Mm. It's one of the best.
Yeah, and then, like I said, this just further cements how... I think that genre in its current iteration has become incredibly formulaic, and this is a fantastic example of how different it can be, like with all these RPG systems. Basically, it does not have to be, you know, this very Dark Souls with the badge system formula that most of them seem to follow right now.
Yeah, why is it that Castlevania hasn't been able to just make it in the 3D world when there has been so many examples of Zelda just knocking out of the park, making non-linear 3D action-adventure platformers. It kind of boggles the mind. Maybe it's just the literal difficulty of translating a whip-based action system in a 3D world, even though they did try to do it in the new Indiana Jones game.
Mm.
To varying degrees of success.
There is a rare 3D Metroidvania that I played quite recently that I'll probably talk about on a future episode. It is tricky to pull off without that full budget, basically, shall we say.
Yeah, well, there are those full 3D Metroid entries, too, some of which have succeeded at varying degrees of success, too.
Yes, Metroid Prime is also on my list coming up soon.
Cool. Well, I've definitely played some of that. All right, I think we've talked enough about Symphony of the Night. Shall we get to our own coda?
Absolutely. Yes, let's jump to desserts, where we talk about some non-gaming treats we've been enjoying.
All right, would you like to go first, or shall I?
Sure, I'll go ahead. So I believe I've spoken various times before about the Shelved by Genre podcast book club, where they talk about speculative fiction, and that this year is all about Lord of the Rings, or Tolkien specifically, over the course of the year 2026. So as part of that, I was read through The Hobbit with my daughter. I was reading it aloud. The first time I've read that book in probably 30 years, or close to that. So that was really fun to come to with a fresh perspective. My daughter quite enjoyed it. As part of that, I just yesterday watched the Rankin Bass adaptation from 1977, it was, which was quite interesting. A very strange adaptation in it being very fast paced. Like, it's just it's extremely breathless. It just does not pause for effect or pacing at all, just constantly charging forward to the next set piece, but incredibly beautiful. Not just in the animation, but just the illustrations and the backdrops. It's really that very 1970s fantasy sort of almost psychedelic aesthetic. But I was surprised. What I learned is that it's animated by a little company called Topcraft, which you might be familiar with, because that they animated Nausicaa, Valley of the Winds, and basically, following a bankruptcy situation, became Studio Ghibli.
Wow. The history, it's all intertwined.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to checking out some of their other movies. The Flight of the Dragons was one that I really enjoyed in my childhood, so I'm going to be revisiting that soon, I think.
Interesting. I have not read The Hobbit. I have not watched any of the Hobbit films.
Oh, you don't need to do that.
Exactly, yeah. I basically decided to boycott that film as soon as I heard that they were making a trilogy out of essentially what was a novella to begin with.
Yeah,
my cash grab.
Reading through the book, it really does bring to light how different in tone it is from The Lord of the Rings. It's a very different authorial voice. It has a very heavy sense of a narrator. You can sort of hear the parent talking to their child with all these little asides and references. And it's very much a fairy tale in the prose style. It's not like character dialogue back and forth. Like the 13 dwarves are very much a homogenous mass. Only like two of them get any real characterization. It's just this sort of set of events trailing from A to B, essentially, and funny things happening along the way.
Yeah, it's really like they're different series, right? Not series at all in some cases. They're different properties because they were never intended to be connected, because they were written years apart from each other, as I recall.
Yeah, and then The Hobbit does have like references to a larger world, but it doesn't feel coherent with The Lord of the Rings, or even with itself in many regards. It's just funny little asides. It's never really... It doesn't have the importance and the epic scope that the both Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films tried to impart it with. This is, that's partly why they feel so out of place, I think, those films.
Yeah, basically, the Hobbit is Dragon Ball to the Lord of the Rings Dragon Ball Z, or Z, as they call it in America. They're just different properties with the same characters. Mm,
a little uncanny.
Yeah. All right, very cool. I would still like to read The Hobbit, though.
Mm, I recommend doing so.
Yeah, it's, how long is it?
I think it's nearly 200 pages, perhaps, but it's a pretty breezy read.
Yeah, it's not very long at all. All right, I'll make it happen this summer. Okay, I also read a novel for my dessert section, and this is, I sort of read this at the same time as I was reading my last novel that I covered, Zodiac. So this is by a novel called The Fold by author Peter Kleins, and I had read one of Peter Kleins' novels years ago. He wrote a novel called 14, and I remember that one pretty fondly, actually. It's not a, you know, epic or anything, but I thought it was simple and effective. It's kind of a simple but creepy tale about this haunted LA apartment complex. So it's sort of like Melrose Place meets H.P. Lovecraft. So I thought that was an interesting blend. And this one similarly blends various genres. It has like this X-Files style cold open with two secondary characters that you'll never meet again. And then you are introduced to the protagonist, who is this unlikely hero. He's kind of like Fox Mulder meets, what is it, Jack Ryan out of the Tom Clancy style novels. He's like this polymath, has an eidetic memory, and a super genius. But he's hiding away in this small town as a high school history teacher or something like that, English teacher. And why is he hiding there? It's because his eidetic memory, which is like, most people call it like perfect memory, right? You remember literally everything. You scan a book and you can remember all of the pages. You can know where every object is within your household at all times, so you can navigate it without the lights off, because you just know everything about everything. So this character is kind of like shuts himself away from the world because he doesn't want to
powerful.
Know everything. Yeah. But he gets pulled into a mission by his childhood friend, who, of course, works for the government or the military or something like that. And he's got to get Mike, the person with the eidetic memory, to help him unravel this sort of mystery. And what is that mystery? The mystery is about this secret off-the-books project that's happening in the desert near San Diego or something like that, where this team has created an invention, and the invention is too good to be true. Let's just say it has something to do with wormholes. So I'm not going to spoil the ending or whatever, but the fun part of the story is that it is too good to be true, and it's all about how Mike is unraveling why exactly it's so hard to believe in with his signature eidetic memory powers. And I thought that this book did, it is pretty inexpertly written. Like, the author, Peter Kleins, has a very kind of, I wouldn't say young adult writing quality, but kind of like that level of seriousness.
It sounds like some tropes that can very easily fall into some power fantasy concept, shall we say.
It is very kind of pulpy. It kind of revels in that. Mm. It's not self-serious. It touches upon a lot of genre fiction, which, of course, I love. Genre pieces. You know, this book has references to, obviously, X-Files, Tom Clancy, Star Trek, Stargate, obviously, when you talk about wormholes. So much of that sort of stuff, but like, I revel in that, right? So it was totally speaking my language. But the main character is interesting enough. He's not like so charming, but like, his flaws are what make him interesting, and his kind of phobias and foibles are what make him interesting. Unfortunately, this was one of the two novels I read recently where I thought that the non-white characters were not very well developed. Mm. There is only really one non-white character of any consequence in this book, and he's sort of a stereotype in his own case. And the other ones are just written like you know, the stern DA was bearing down on him with his bad attitude, and then the Asian DA was saying this, and it's like, what the hell, man?
Sometimes you're better off just writing what you know rather than trying to force it, right?
Yeah, and also like, why are white people the default? Is it that everyone else who's not described to have an ethnicity is white, right? Because this is an English novel. The only people that can speak English are white, obviously, or care about English are white. So, you know, that has to be it. White is the default state of being for protagonists and side characters of fiction. Well, I don't know. I don't believe that that is the case. So it's unfortunate that the last two books treated their characters that way. But this, you know, this is a product of its time. And this book, I thought, for how flawed it is, it had some interesting ideas. This, like I said, is sort of a mystery story, and I won't unravel the ending, but it does climax to, from a slow start to like a really just like frenetic climax, into like full-on like action movie level, like just extreme explosive action happening near the end. And then they wrap it up really neatly. It sort of felt like they were opening it up to sequels. Obviously, every book has to be a series now. So it sort of ended up wrapping like, hey, this is the end of season one of a TV show. And of course, we're going to the same cast of characters is going to go for another ride next summer. So that part of it was a little bit unfortunate, but I
Jack
did.
Jack Ryan Wooten.
Yes, I did. For how predictable, I guess, this ride was, it was an enjoyable one with the bumps and jumps and scares in the right places.
It's like the old Penny Dreadfuls, that you just want something familiar that you can flip through and have a good time.
I have no reason to complain because I love genre novels. I read Shadowrun and I read I read Shadowrun novels and I read Star Trek novels, and they're great because they're predictable, right? Like they bring me back to a fun place with characters I like, and this is similar in that sense that it references things that I like, so I have no reason to complain other than the small complaints that I made in other places. Peter Klein, interesting author, not the best highbrow stuff, but not the same old standard sci-fi either, so in that case I enjoy it.
Excellent. Okay, well, if you have any questions or comments about any of the games or genre novels that we've discussed today, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can watch videos of our episodes that we put up on YouTube. Please subscribe. Leave a comment there if you haven't yet. And if you do want to check into some of our older back catalog, you can catch those only in audio form on a podcatcher of your choosing. Please check those out. We talk about a range of games, not always the latest hotness, whatever we want on whatever we happen to be playing. We do this just for the fun. We don't have any ads. We just do this as a labor of love, so we'd love to hear your feedback. Please let us know what games you're enjoying or would like us to cover in the future. You can follow me, maybe. You can continue to follow me on Blue Sky at markyuasa.bsky.social. And yourself, Daniel?
You can find me at Board Game Feast, also at Blue Sky, and the Omni Gamers Club account there on Blue Sky as well.
Very cool. All right. I am excited to think about some new topics we're going to have to cover. We've been playing some more RPGs. You and I have both played some of our bucket list RPGs recently, so we're definitely going to be able to talk about those. And I'm starting a new mini campaign of a new system this week, so that's something the listeners can look forward to.
And I've got some rumblings of a potential Wildsea game, maybe, so looking forward to trying that. Also, I've been playing a lot of, obviously, Slay the Spire 2. I have been playing it. I'm taking my time. It's going to take some time to like really dig into what's different there, but yeah, lots to talk about.
Very cool. All right, well, we're back. For those who stuck with us, thank you so much. And we'll be continuing to release episodes on a semi-regular basis.
We'll see what happens when I'm working again.
There you go. Cool, cool. All right, Daniel. I'll talk to you again soon enough.
Thank you, Mark. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Remember to have a balanced diet of games. Bye.
Bye-bye.